From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. South Korea's president says North Korea is showing maniacal recklessness after its latest nuclear test, described as its biggest ever. State-run television in North Korea gleefully announced that it was now capable of mounting a nuclear warhead on a ballistic rocket. Of course, there's been an outcry around the world and doubts. The BBC's Steve Evans is in Seoul, South Korea. Steve, what more do we know about North Korea's claims?
We know we should take them with a pinch of salt. They've made the claim that they've got a nuclear device small enough to go on a missile before. What we do know is true is that their technology is moving forward. Five nuclear tests. They are firing missiles further and further. They're not at the situation yet where they can put a warhead, a nuclear warhead, on top of a missile and send it across the Pacific Ocean, for example. So there are lots of claims, but in the past you get the sense that they've been exaggerated. They've been talking them up a little bit too much.
Yeah. Well, South Korea's presidential office said that they had a conversation with President Obama right after news of the launch, and that the leaders agreed to use every method, including a UN Security Council resolution. But is there thinking that anything could stop the North Koreans from this testing? Sanctions haven't worked.
Sanctions haven't worked. And you listen to the condemnation today, Robin, on the fifth test, and it's almost a cut and paste from the condemnation after the fourth test, which was back in January. After that test back in January, and they launched, they said it was a satellite. A lot of people on the outside said it was a test of a missile. And the UN went into overdrive, lots and lots of condemnation, including from China. And at the end of it all, sanctions were tightened. Nobody thinks that regime is about to collapse. North Korea watchers talk about collapsism, that Pyongyang can't go on much longer, the regime is going to collapse soon. But, you know, collapsism has been going on for 20 years now. The place is very poor. I was there about 6 months ago. But it's not grinding poverty, or certainly not in Pyongyang. They're not starving. You know, they walk long distances. There are not many cars. They've got solar panels. Some of them have got solar panels on their apartment, on the outside of the apartments. You know, there are blackouts, but they make do. This is not a country which has been ground down towards rebellion, or not at the moment anyway. So what are they going to do? I mean, there could be more sanctions, like not selling fuel oil to North Korea, and that would stop the economy, and it would also hurt an awful lot of ordinary people. Would it bring down Kim Jong-un? Who knows?
What about China? China is really North Korea's only ally in the world, but the foreign ministry in Beijing said it would issue a formal protest to North Korea's ambassador in China. It seems like even China is fed up, but does that matter?
It matters that China is fed up, and I think China is fed up. But is China going to topple that regime? I think probably not. What China does not want is the collapse of that regime in Pyongyang in a chaotic fashion, you know, like the end of Libya or something like that, with all kinds of forces let loose and that vacuum filled by the US. China does not want US troops on its border. So, sure, it doesn't like what Pyongyang's doing, but it can't control Pyongyang. What it would like even less is that chaotic vacuum filled by your people, basically.
Filled by Americans. Well, Steve Evans of the BBC, why do you think this is happening now, this ramp up of the nuclear program to nuclear tests in recent months?
He's in a rush to get the arsenal, you know, to get the nuclear weapons ready, whether he fears that he may be toppled, you know, whether he fears that American special forces or South Korean special forces might engage in what's called a decapitation, a beheading operation, where you bring the regime down by assassinating the top man. He's clearly in a rush. Now, there are some outside experts who say, if you really want to be sure about developing these kind of weapons, you do your test and you probably wait quite a long time, because that kind of analysis of what went wrong and what could be improved takes time. But the counter view is maybe he can feel the pressure from his own people. You know, there are 30,000 Chinese tourists in North Korea these days every year. Mm. And those Chinese tourists, they take their fancy cameras, they take their Burberry bags, they have all the trappings of prosperous Westerners. And there might be people in Pyongyang thinking, well, hold on a minute, there's something outside this country, you know, and it may look a little bit better than what we've got.
The BBC's Steve Evans speaking to us from Seoul. Steve, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Well, in New Jersey, jury selection is underway this week in a federal trial over something that happened 3 years ago today in Fort Lee.
At 211 Fort Lee, traffic is a nightmare.
10-4, we're getting calls from irate motorists.
We've been actually notified. Possible injury should weigh in for over now.
You are aware the town is a total gridlock, correct?
Be advised, the traffic starts at the GW. It backs up all the way through Palisade Ave to the end of town by Route 5.
The GW bridge is totally gridlocked. If you can come up maybe Fort Lee Road or something to that effect.
Those are just some of the hours of 911 calls recorded over 4 days in September of 2013 when local access lanes to the George Washington Bridge were closed in the scandal now known as Bridgegate. Well, two former aides to New Jersey Governor Chris Christie are now on trial for allegedly orchestrating the traffic jam as an act of political retribution for a mayor who didn't endorse Christie's reelection. Matt Katz is a political reporter for WNYC and author of the book American Governor Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. He's with us now. Hi, Matt.
Hi there, Jeremy.
And just briefly remind us of what happened back on this day in 2013 at the foot of the George Washington Bridge.
Sure thing. So Chris Christie is running for re-election as governor of New Jersey, and the mayor of Fort Lee decides not to endorse him. This apparently infuriated some of Christie's aides, so they decided to close lanes to the bridge, which went into New York City, so commuters in the morning rush would be clogged in this town, Fort Lee, which is at the foot of the bridge. And that's exactly what happened for several mornings in a row. Jeremy, this traffic was so bad that ambulance drivers were getting out of their vehicles and running to the scene of incidents. Hmm. And if you listen to what federal prosecutors have alleged, the traffic jams were planned for the first day of school in order to maximize the pain on the people of Fort Lee.
And Chris Christie has always denied any involvement in or knowledge of the decision to close the lanes. And he fired aides who were found to have been involved. And now two of those aides, Bridget Ann Kelly, who was Christie's former deputy chief of staff, and Bill Baroni, who was one of Christie's top appointees at the Port Authority, are going on trial. Jury selection started yesterday. What are they charged with?
They're charged with misusing public property and interfering with the public's right to transportation and the free access to transportation and assorted other corruption charges. They are defending themselves by saying that they could not have possibly done this on their own. They're going to either directly or indirectly insinuate that they were taking orders from on high. The reporters that will be packing into the courtroom will be trying to figure out how high this conspiracy really went. We know that there were other conspirators. That's what the feds say. They just didn't have enough evidence to charge those folks. And we don't know who those people are. We're hoping, the press is at least, we're hoping to find out some names and figure out who else in the administration was involved in this and what the governor himself may have known or may have not known.
And so far, no evidence has been found linking Christie himself to the lane closures, correct?
That's correct. Although we have gotten some information in the last few weeks that is somewhat intriguing. For example, the governor had said that he handed over his personal and public email accounts to federal investigators. There was apparently one private email account he used with his wife that he used for government business. He did not turn that over, we've learned. There's also a cell phone that instead of giving to federal prosecutors, he instead gave to his attorneys who went through the cell phone and decided which information to hand over to investigators. The third piece of evidence we learned was a text message that a former aide to Christie sent while the governor was giving a press conference denying any involvement in this. And this aide writes, "The governor is flat out lying right now." So there are some peculiar questions that hopefully get some answers to in the courtroom.
And whatever happens with this trial, how much would you say Bridgegate has already affected Christie politically, both in and outside of New Jersey?
I've covered the governor for 5.5 years, and it's my contention that this ruined his political career in the short term. It certainly damaged him tremendously in New Jersey. He was extraordinarily popular, and now he is one of the most unpopular governors in modern New Jersey history. As far as his presidential campaign, he did terribly in that race, and right before Bridgegate broke in December of 2013, he was actually leading the field of potential Republican nominees.
Yeah.
More than anything, I think it made a lot of the billionaires who were pledging to back his candidacy, they got some scandal fatigue after Bridgegate broke, and they were very concerned about how damaged he might have been, and they decided to move on to other candidates. And I think that was the real problem in the beginning of that race, more than anything else.
And just very briefly, Matt, he's now very involved with the Trump campaign. Is this likely to have any impact on that?
It's going to add some more intrigue into it for sure. Donald Trump, when these guys were still running against each other for president, had said that Christie definitely knew about the bridge scandal. So it's kind of that's a kind of a funny footnote, but it will get some more media attention, I'm sure, since Christie is the transition chairman for the Trump campaign.
That's Matt Katz, a political reporter for WNYC, as jury selection is underway in the trial over Bridgegate, a couple of former aides to Chris Christie. Matt, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Sunday is the 15th anniversary of 9/11. Yesterday, we spoke with 15-year-olds just born in 2001. Today, teachers from Brooklyn's PS 146. Now, one of the famous features of the school, huge windows that look out across the East River at the Manhattan skyline, which is where many teachers' gazes were directed on 9/11 when planes crashed into the World Trade Center towers and brought them down. How are they handling what they saw? And what happens when a new child comes across an old picture and says, as they do, hey, where'd they go? Those are questions award-winning author Jewel Parker Rhodes asked in her new YA novel, Towers Falling, which was inspired by PS 146. We'll link you to our July talk at hereandnow.org. As we ask some of the school's faculty those questions, Antoinette Byam has been teaching fifth grade at the new school, PS 146, for 20 years. Welcome, Antoinette.
Hello.
Jenny Hardy has been there for 16 years teaching first and second grade. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And Principal Anna Allenbrook has been at PS 146 for almost 30 years. Principal Allenbrook, Anna, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you all, first of all, for your teaching service for so many years. So many years in this school. Obviously, this building means a lot to you. So take us back. Jewel Parker Rhodes writes that, you know, there were teachers looking through that window that might have seen the second plane flying into the towers. Did they?
Yes. Mm. One of my colleagues came in and said, the children are asking about those funny clouds in the sky. And I looked up and I said, I don't think they're clouds. And just as I said that, another plane hit the second tower. Mm. So, yeah, it was quite shocking.
Jenny Hardy, what a horrendous thing. You had second graders at the time.
Yes. And I remember hearing so many sirens that it caused me to look out the window and made a decision to close my shades. And I continued our morning as normal, as normal as possible.
Principal Allenbrook, what happened to some of your teachers because they had that front row seat?
It's so hard to talk about it. I think one of the things that struck me about 9/11 is that it's only in the last year or so that we've actually found ourselves able to talk about it. So one thing that happened was we became very quiet about our own upset. There was at least one teacher that we think left New York. It was too upsetting.
And I have to say, am I hearing you correctly? You've only really been able to talk about it in the last year, almost 15 years on?
Yes, I think I've noticed that we're talking about it more recently than we did in the past. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Part of teaching is you always wonder what has happened to the children you've taught. And then when you think about the children, you think about, oh, yeah, that's the child who was in my class on September 11th. And then that makes you begin to think about the day and how that day was handled, the children that you were with, and, you know, how you had to think about them and their families. It takes a while to unravel all of the I guess, all of the layers that you feel about, you know, the things that have happened then, and you talk about it bit by bit by bit, and then you begin to think, yeah, that's what happened.
As soon as we came back to school, we gathered as a community, and we did sing lots of songs of love and peace, which is a tradition we've carried on since then, every year, either on or close to September 11th, including today. We gather as a community to sing songs of joy and peace and love to comfort each other because of the events of that day.
Well, but the conceit of Jewel Parker Rhodes' book is that, and you just said it, Principal Allenbrook, that the teachers haven't been able to talk about it, and yet you have new children coming in. And Antoinette Byam, again, teaching fifth grade, I'm imagining maybe some teachers haven't wanted to talk about it, but kids have been asking about it.
Yeah, and I don't think it's that we don't want to talk about it. You know, teaching is often guided by what children want to know. You know, there are things you want them to learn, and then there are things that they want to know. In our case in particular, the classroom windows face the Twin Towers. We can see the new buildings that have gone up. You know, we see the construction that's going on. So it's been an ongoing discussion over the years that there was something there before and there is something new going up, and why does something new have to go up? So it is an ongoing conversation, but it's based on the questions that children have.
Yeah. This is Jenny. In my class, I actually do introduce the subject. I wasn't able to find any books that were appropriate for young kids, so I wrote one. And every year before our sing, I read it to my children and explain to them what happened. I think it's important to do that, even though it's a little frightening for six-year-olds, because it's part of a history, it's part of who we are. I think it's important for them to realize how communities can help each other through a difficult thing.
Jenny Hardy, again, first and second grade teacher, I have to ask you, what do you say in your book? Just give us a sense of it.
The title is, Why Do We Commemorate September 11th? And I talked about the architect and how the building symbolized power and why it was the target that day.
How do you say who did it and why?
I was really careful about that. I didn't want to use the word terrorist, so I used the word extremist. And I give examples of other extremists that exist in the world.
This must be frightening, Jenny, for them. How do they respond?
Some children have been told about it at home in their families, and for others it's new information. But most of them will see the lights beaming and then understand that those lights are representing the buildings that once stood.
Principal Allenbrook, as we read in Jewel Parker Rhodes' fictionalized version of your school, there's a group of 10-year-olds. There's a homeless girl who's never heard of the attacks. And it turns out that her father is actually suffering from post-traumatic stress because he was in the towers. But then she and her friends, they want to know. They want answers. And they're all going online. And they're finding videos that most American adults have not looked at. The carnage around the towers. People jumping. This is described in the book that they're seeing this. Have you come across this, that kids are looking anyway for answers?
They're always finding ways to gather more information, sometimes than we are studying in class, and coming up with theories of their own based on the information that they have, and definitely coming up with more and more questions.
Yeah. But again, Principal Allenbrook, you've just expressed that teachers have had a hard time speaking about it, you know, for almost 15 years. What's it like to have the constant reminders, the windows and looking out, and the new curious, bright little faces every year, new ones?
That's the joy of teaching, that there are always new, bright little faces. And it is something that we have to remember, that this group of children, you know, had no experience of 9/11. We had the group that experienced it. Then we had the group that heard a lot about it, the group who parents were very protective of them because they were so frightened. And now we have a new generation of children where I think in some ways there's a lot more hope.
I'm wondering if that's maybe helping the teachers. Antoinette, Jenny, I'm wondering if there's ever any times, Jenny, you said you pulled your blinds on 9/11. Is there still any time where you just can't look out there?
Oh, it's so interesting. That day was such a beautiful day in New York City. And any time there is a beautiful morning in New York City, I'm always reminded of that morning. And I do look across the river, and I do miss the towers, which, to be honest, I was never that fond of, but now I do miss them. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think there are times when we look and we're reminded.
Yeah. And for a long time, this is Anna, for a long time there was just like almost a hole in the vista, and that's changed now, of course, but I can remember feeling that.
Yeah. Well, and as you said, you have this new crop of kids every year, which always signifies hope. Other teachers have said, and I think I heard it from one of you, well, we didn't have a curriculum. We didn't have a way to teach it. Jenny Hardy, you wrote your own book. Now you have this book, Towers Falling. In it, the kids do things like they learn about the history of the building, the architects, just what you were saying, Jenny. They try to build a building out of pipe cleaners. They have projects. And a couple of the kids play hooky, and they go to ground zero because they're so desperate to know what happened. Does this book give you a little bit of a curriculum?
I think it gives another way to talk about it. It validates the importance of the inquiry of children and to the importance of inclusion. Yeah.
And I think it also opens the conversation. I know that Antoinette mentioned that the book was in the classroom today, mm-hmm. and one of the children picked it up. That's a start right mm-hmm. there.
Antoinette, what do you say when a child might pick up the book Falling Towers or come across an old picture and realize the towers fell and they're frightened? What do you say to them?
Well, we always come back to the line that you can't control what other people do, but you can control how you respond. And that gives you a lot of power. So just like the children in the book who have, you know, taken that power to construct something, we also have that power to construct something and make new things and turn situations into as positive as we want them to be.
That's Antoinette Byam. She's been teaching the fifth grade at PS 146 for 20 years. Jenny Hardy's been at the school teaching first and second grade for 16 years. And Principal Anna Allenbrook, wow, she's been there almost 30 years. Thank you all so much for your work and for speaking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
There is a presidential election in France next year, and it appears President François Hollande may seek a second term, despite his unpopularity with the French people. Yesterday, the socialist Hollande laid out his vision of democracy and said the vote next year would be decisive for the future of Europe. Joining us now from Paris on Skype is the BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse. And Gabriel, is Hollande running again, and why is he so unpopular?
Well, it looked yesterday like he was, because he made this big speech and he talked about not running on a platform of national identity, of this sort of identitarian politics that seems to have caught on in France, this vexed question of the veil and what are French values, etc. Why is François Hollande so unpopular? He's the most unpopular president in French history. I think it's twofold, really. On the one hand, he's presided over a massive increase in unemployment and the euro crisis, which is rightly or wrongly blamed by many on him. And on the other hand, there have been these huge terrorist attacks in France, in Paris, Nice and elsewhere. And he is just not seen as strong in that field. And so that's why you're seeing a lot of other candidates going on and on about national security, terrorism, and the question of Islam.
And one of them is Nicolas Sarkozy, the former French president, who is seeking the Conservative Party nomination. Is he likely to win the presidency again?
Well, so Nicolas Sarkozy was the previous holder of that dubious accolade of least popular president in French history. He was the least popular president in French history when he lost to François Hollande in 2012. Now, I went to see a rally of his yesterday. He's a great performer. I mean, he's small in stature. He's physically small, but he's punchy. He's persuasive. Certainly the people in this rural town that I saw seemed to be lapping it up. He was talking, as I said, about national security, about identity. He has said he wants to ban the veil in public places. He wants to secure the country's borders. It's the kind of stuff that you might hear at a Trump rally. And it seems like this is the kind of stuff that the French, many French, are in the mood for. Whether he can overcome the personal antipathy that a lot of French people felt towards him when he was president, I think that remains to be seen.
Well, it's interesting that you say that's the kind of stuff you would hear at a Trump rally, because the person in France who's most often compared to Trump is the far-right leader Marine Le Pen. First of all, is she likely to run for the presidency? And if so, will she have much success?
Okay, so she is definitely going to run for the presidency, and she is very likely to get through to the second round. So just briefly how it works, what happens is you get a whole bunch of candidates who stand in the first round, and unless one of them gets 50% in that first, 50% or more in that first round, they go on to a second round, pitting the two top performers against each other. Almost nobody ever gets through the first round with more than 50%, so it's likely that we will have a runoff. And in that runoff, at the moment in the polls, it looks like Marine Le Pen, the sort of Trump-style candidate, if you like, the leader of the Front National, the National Front, will go through to the second round. And when that happens, well, we don't really know what will happen then. The last time a Front National candidate got through to the second round, it was Marine Le Pen's father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, and he got through the second round. What happened was that the centre-left and centre-right then united against him and defeated him.
That's the BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse speaking with us from Paris, well ahead of the election. Their election is long after our election in this country, but we'll be watching. Gabriel, thank you.
My pleasure.
A new Quinnipiac University survey shows Donald Trump with a 4-point lead over Hillary Clinton in the key state of Ohio when third-party candidates are included. Without the other candidates, Clinton almost ties it, but Trump leads. His appeal is especially strong along the eastern side of the state in places like Harrison County, with about 16,000 residents and a history of coal mining. Nick Castell of Here Now contributor WCPN IdeaStream has been talking with Trump supporters there and has this report.
Don Rogers is sitting on his porch in Caddis, Ohio. He's almost 60 years old, he's wearing a Harley-Davidson baseball cap, and he speaks through a bushy blonde beard. He says politicians don't even know we exist. Trump, on the other hand, Rogers says he's for us.
Because he said one thing that I did like, these politicians has been in there for a while, 25, 30 years, and that hasn't done nothing yet. It's time for them to go.
Rogers says he worked in a coal mine until it closed for a time in the 1980s. That was a hard decade for Harrison County. In 1985, unemployment reached 24%. The number of people working in mining there today is a fraction of what it was in 1980. Unemployment in Harrison County this summer was almost 7%, higher than the state average. Though more people are working today than during the most recent recession, Rogers doesn't sound optimistic about the economy as he points out vacant houses on his street.
Just come sit on my porch and you'll see for yourself. You're looking at shacks. Windows beat out, no gutters, downspouts, or nothing on their houses.
As mining declined, natural gas drilling grew. A gas company leased the right to drill on farmland the Rogers family owns. Rogers' 20-year-old son, Don Rogers II, joins him on the porch. He graduated from high school and has vocational certificates, but hasn't found work yet. Like his father, he supports Trump.
You know, he's going to get the illegals out, and then if they go get their citizenship or whatever, green card, they can come back. I think that's fair.
Down the street, Rebecca Corder sits outside with a neighbor. Her husband seals off parts of coal mines for a living while she takes care of the kids. She supports Trump, too.
I know Trump's going to make people work instead of those people that don't work every day and sit on their butt and get welfare and free insurance and eat good and all that stuff when us working people are struggling every single day. We pay $800 a month just to have insurance.
The county voted for Democrat Ted Strickland over John Kasich in the 2010 governor's race, but the last Democratic presidential candidate to win here was Bill Clinton in 1996. Rich Millison, the chairman of the Harrison County Democratic Party, says the area has become more conservative over the last 20 years as union jobs declined.
There's no more local representation to represent that worker in the workplace. I think Donald Trump is speaking to those people.
A meeting of the Harrison County Republican Party begins with prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance. Looking out over the room are photos of movie star Clark Gable, who was born in Caddis. Many here describe in different ways a similar feeling, that the country is changing and not to their liking. For Barry Momeyer, that change is in social issues and President Obama's decision to commute the sentences of hundreds of federal inmates.
If you look at the culture, a lot of fatherless families now. Now abortion, it's okay to kill babies. That's all right. Now with Obama releasing how many prisoners, now the prisoners are good and the cops are bad.
Another Republican at the meeting, Josh Willis, is running for county auditor. He recalls a comment Hillary Clinton made at a town hall in Columbus in March.
I'm a coal miner, and I am literally voting for my livelihood this year. Hillary is anti-coal. She came to Ohio and said that she's going to put coal miners out of work.
She also said she doesn't want to forget those workers and touted a plan to bring renewable energy jobs to coal country. Still, for people in this area, the word stung. Paul Coughlin is a GOP candidate for county commissioner. While elections are usually cast as contests between Democrats and Republicans, Coughlin offers a different way of looking at it.
Do you want your country to remain sovereign with laws and borders? Or do you want to move to a globalist, not only economy with trade that kills us, no borders?
The latter is where he believes the country is headed, and he says Trump will shake things up. For Here and Now, I'm Nick Castell.
Well, this election season, we're also following Senate and House races, which brings us to this week's district profile. Today, we're looking at the race in the 3rd District of Louisiana. There is an open seat because Republican incumbent Charles Bustani Jr. is running for Senate. And joining us to talk about it is Sue Lincoln, politics anchor at WRKF in Baton Rouge. Sue, first of all, can you describe the district for us and its voting history?
Well, it's the Acadiana area of Louisiana, which has been in the past predominantly Democratic, has since recently, as Louisiana turned red, become primarily Republican. But there's a pocket over in the western area of the district, in the Lake Charles area, that still votes Democratic. And the folks in the Lafayette area, which is the bigger population center of the district, do tend to vote more Republican. But for years and years and years, the Acadiana area, the Cajun descendants, have been their own wild card in almost any race.
And for this race, this is going to be very different than what most of our listeners are used to because it is a jungle primary, which is what happens in Louisiana. Candidates from the parties run together. If one of the candidates gets a majority, that person wins. Otherwise, there's a runoff later on. Tell us a little bit about the 12 candidates running. You don't have to go through each one, but give us a sense.
Okay, we've got 12 candidates, but I'm going to run down the 4 that are leading in the polls. At the head of the list is the one with the most money. That is Scott Angel. He is currently a public service commissioner. They regulate the utilities here in Louisiana. But he ran for governor last year, and he came in 3rd in that particular race. Behind him in the polls is a gentleman named Clay Higgins. Many of you may know of him from his appearances on YouTube as the Cajun John Wayne. Hmm. He is a former sheriff's deputy, and he is definitely pro-law and order. In addition, behind him, we have Greg Ellison, who is the owner of Kitty Hawk Energy, an oil and gas company. He's a businessman. Mm-hmm. There's just no other way to describe them. Last but not least, in the top 4, we have Brett Guyman, who is a former state lawmaker, a state representative. He was the leader of a group known as the Fiscal Hawks, and he led the opposition to Common Core here in Louisiana. So that's what you've got.
And they're all Republicans, by the way.
Those are all Republicans. There are a few Democrats in the race. One of interest to some people is a gentleman named Jacob Dorian Fibian Hebert. He is a visual artist and musician. He is known as the Cajun Robert Plant, and he is running strictly to be the opposite candidate to the Cajun John Wayne, Clay Higgins.
I guess if you're running for office down there, you've got to have a Cajun nickname to go along with your name.
Well, you don't have to, but it helps a little
okay.
bit.
Well, let's listen to a montage that we've got of ads from the top 4 candidates that you mentioned, all Republicans. Here they are.
Now our police officers are under attack, targets of hate and violence. It's got to stop. We need more people backing the badge and fewer people attacking the badge.
Our own allies across the globe no longer trust us. Our borders are no longer sovereign. Our cities are on fire. Our police are murdered in the street.
America hasn't lost its way. Washington has.
career politicians meddle in our lives, hurt job creators, and fail to keep our communities safe.
So I want people to understand and know that I am a conservative, but I'm not always a party person.
How has Donald Trump factored into this race? Who's backing him? Who isn't?
Well, Scott Angel hasn't said much one way or another whether he's backing him. Clay Higgins is definitely behind Donald Trump. I can't say one way or another regarding Mr. Ellison, though he is a loyal Republican Party person. And I suspect Brett Guyman, who I've known for a number of years, I think he is probably not going to say not to avoid either alienating the party or alienating other Republicans.
That's Sue Lincoln, a politics anchor at WRKF in Baton Rouge, talking with us about Louisiana's 3rd District for our district profile this week. Sue, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Did you know over the last few years, about 100,000 people in the U.S. have been sued for allegedly downloading and distributing pornography? The lawsuits come in the form of threatening letters that suggest the recipients pay now to avoid going to court. Northern Illinois sees more of these than anywhere else in the country. What's going on? Miles Bryan of WBEZ in Chicago has more.
When Alex got the letter in the spring of 2011, it freaked him out on a whole bunch of levels. First, there was the money.
Can you read me this paragraph that starts with copyright?
All right. Copyright law allows for statutory damages ranging from $750 to $30,000 per infringed work, $150,000 if willful.
Then there's what that video was, a gay porn film called The Warehouse. Alex, a 45-year-old IT guy with a wife and a kid, says his wife believed him when he told her he didn't download the movie. He asked us to keep his last name private for this story.
If my name is there on the net connected to gay pornography, so it may be not so good for me if potential employers are looking for making their research.
At the time, Alex felt totally alone. He wasn't. Loyola University law professor Matthew Sagg says this kind of lawsuit is a phenomenon. It's known as copyright trolling, and he says it's happening all over the country.
This is all driven by, let's be generous and call them entrepreneurial lawyers. Step one, find a client with some copyrighted property that is being infringed on the internet.
Step two is find the people they think are downloading that property, usually adult video. Step three, file a lawsuit and demand a payment. The lawsuit is initially filed against John Doe. Settle and nobody will ever have to know your name. But fight it?
Then there's also a threat, sometimes implicit, but usually explicit, that we will forever attach your name on the public record to the downloading of, insert whatever pornographic title you want.
Porn-related copyright trolling lawsuits rose from about 3% of all federal copyright cases in 2010 to 40% of those cases last year. Matthew Sagg says owners of copyrighted material, no matter what it is, do have a legal right to protect it.
The problem here is the way these settlements are leveraged. This extreme personal threat, this extreme invasion of privacy, coupled with this extreme economic threat. You know, if it's not extortion, it's certainly, I think, for many people, an intolerable degree of pressure.
When Alex, the IT guy, got a letter 5 years ago saying he was being sued for stealing a porn video, it had the name of an attorney on it, D. Gil Sperline. So I called him. I mean, a question I got to ask you is, you know, is this extortion?
It's not. I represent a lot of clients that make adult film. I don't associate any shame with it, and if someone else does, I feel bad for them.
Sperline says stealing porn is the same as stealing anything else, illegal. And he says the adult film companies he's represented, they don't make money at the box office or with mainstream advertisers. Film sales are really all they've got.
What's the option my clients have? Is it because they're an adult film production that they don't have a right to protect their interests the same way that Hollywood has? That doesn't seem very fair. Does it?
Still, these copyright infringement letters land in the mailboxes of lots of people who have no idea why they're being sued, says Jeffrey Antonelli. He's a Chicago lawyer that specializes in defending people charged with illegally downloading porn. Antonelli says half of the clients he works with tell him they're innocent. Often it's an older person with a mischievous grandkid who uses their internet, or someone who doesn't password protect their Wi-Fi. Even so, a lot of these clients don't want to go to court.
Oftentimes people will tell us, look, I can't deal with this. This will put my job at risk or my reputation in the community. To have me named in a copyright lawsuit involving pornography could be devastating. So I want to settle.
Alex, the IT worker, contested the lawsuit brought against him, and eventually his case was dismissed. But two other people who were sued in the same case Alex was, they ignored the letters and were ordered by a court to pay $20,000 each. And at least in Illinois, these copyright cases don't look like they'll be stopping anytime soon. Recently, a defendant in a Northern Illinois copyright case argued that he should be allowed to remain anonymous in court because the company suing him was leveraging his fear of embarrassment to force a settlement. The judge ruled against him. For Here and Now, I'm Miles Bryan in Chicago.
Well, as we close out this hour of the show, some sounds from Capitol Hill today, where members of Congress gathered on the Capitol steps to remember 9/11, as they also did on that tragic day. This time, Speaker Paul Ryan led the audience in a moment of silence. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi also spoke. And after the speeches, the Marine Band performed God Bless America with members of Congress singing along. Some sounds from Capitol Hill today. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.